KOSP through your local cable TV system, we'd like to hear from you. A call from you will help KOSP claim our share of the copyright payments your cable system makes every year to the federal government. We'd like to know where you live, the name of your cable system, how long you've listened to us over the cable, and what programming on KOSP is valuable to you. Please phone our listener comment line toll-free at 1-888-549-6421 and leave us a message about your cable listening. Or visit our website at kusb.org.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI.
It is Saturday, July 9th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. in Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news, and we take your calls and comments. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. And if you're thinking, wow, that theme song sounds a little tinny, once again, I forgot my cables, and Ben and I, being geeks, we just made it work.
Yes, we did.
So, let's try that again?
Yes, we did.
There we go. In the second half of the show, we will be inviting you to join us by phone with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 800-655-5877. Once again, I'm Miles Elam. In the air room with me is Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy and Stanford instructor.
How's it going?
And your first news story, sir.
Yeah. Hey, guess what, guys? We're in space on a shuttle. For the last time. For the last time in probably a really, really long time.
Well, the last time that the U.S. Space Agency is going to be sending people
out. And to be clear, we'll be in space tomorrow, you know, and the next day, but this is the last mission up to space. I'm about to qualify using the Space Shuttle program. So this is the Shuttle Atlantis, and this is the last flight for the entire program. And the program's been around for quite a while. This really made me giggle because this space station, Atlantis, or sorry, this space shuttle, Atlantis, had its first flight about a month before I was born. So, I mean, I'm pretty young, but this is...
Yeah, I was about to say, that's not saying much. I mean...
yeah, I'm like 12.
You were born after Star Wars.
I know. It's, yeah.
Born after the second movie, too. Wait, were you born after all three movies?
85.
Oh, wow.
Was I?
I'm
sorry, I'm not enough of a geek. I don't know when the Star Wars movies came out. I know when Star Trek Next Generation stopped or finished in the 90s, early 90s. I was definitely alive by then.
And now that I feel old, I'll just go off here.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's kind of sad, but I mean, you know, I'm 25 and the space shuttle is 25, almost 26, because it had its first flight on the 3rd of October, 1985. I mean, but just imagine building something like this, you know, like even today, imagine building something like this. Imagine building something like this in the 80s. I mean, it's kind of tremendous. And this thing is absolutely huge. So, but yeah, sadly, it is the last mission.
So now what do we do when we need to get stuff launched into space?
We flap our wings, our arms. No, I don't know. Well, we've got private industry. Private industry is kind of hopefully swoop into the scene. And,
yeah, they're
and
ways off they're from ways doing off. Something like that. We're basically going to other countries.
Have our friends, the Russians, you know. Actually, you know, this is one of the things that the space shuttle did really nicely is it kind of... was somewhat of a catalyst for bringing a lot of nations together, including the Soviets after the Cold War and everything like that. And after
they were
the
no longer
race.
Soviets after the Cold War, just so you know, they're Russians.
I'm sorry.
The Russian Federation.
Yes, sorry. Anyway, so yeah, it's it's been a really good, I guess, 26 years. Now they're going to do a couple scientific things here up on this mission. They're bringing, what is it, like 8 tons? It's either 8 tons or 4 tons. I've got my many devices here. I'm looking at my Kindle right now. Sorry. Okay, 8,000 pounds of supplies and spare parts, and that's going to help sustain the space station after the shuttles are retired, which is as soon as this next one lands. And after this one lands, they're all going to the museums, so you'll be able to check them out.
So, about that Kindle.
About that Kindle, yeah. I just got this literally yesterday.
Wait, we talked about the iPad quite a bit, and we've only talked about the Kindle in passing. Yeah. But we haven't had one in the air room. So
I know it's...
well, we haven't had that hands-on experience to say, like, oh, this is what we actually think of it.
Here, you can hold it if you want. Now, here's actually something that I find really interesting. If you look at Apple, and you look at Google, and you look at Facebook, and then you look at all of the other companies, HTC and everyone, who make Android devices and all the press that gets, all those companies get tons and tons of press and tons, like they're really under the microscope in a lot of ways. But Amazon is really an interesting company to me because it's not under the microscope hardly at all. I mean, you don't really hear about it much, but they sell so much. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it was, you know, a pretty high number as far as like the amount of goods that are sold to consumers in the United States. How much is sold on Amazon? It's kind of ridiculous, you know? It's to the point where, you know, Amazon not paying sales tax is a really big issue for you know,
government. Yeah, we covered that topic.
Exactly, we covered that last week. So it's kind of interesting to see a company like that really not get any... Hey, I want my Kindle back. It's really interesting to see a company like that not really get much attention except when they want it. So they're kind of in an interesting space.
Yeah, I was thinking as I was holding that Kindle, that because I have an iPad and I've been reading some books on that iPad, the difference between them, aside from the fact the size difference, my mm-hmm. iPad is larger than that entry-level size Kindle that you mm-hmm. have there. And at the same time, the e-ink that's used by the Kindle is mm-hmm. so sharp and so readable.
Like, yeah, so to give an idea of what this is, basically, instead of a normal screen that's backlit, so you have a light coming from behind, and that's kind of difficult to read sometimes or difficult to look at, especially at night, this e-ink technology, it's basically, it turns on and off these quote-unquote pixels, but they're really just... It's almost like splotches of ink. I'm not exactly sure as to the technology that powers it, but it's basically like ink. It's like,
well, it doesn't require any power to keep the state. It takes power to change the state.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of like you know those signs. Oh, let me see. Where do we see them at like train stations and everything? Where or like the roadside signs where each of the little pixels will flip over and either be like a bright reflective green or it'll be a black, you know, and it'll just take power to change the state of that. But once it's changed, you just have some green or some black, and it's not like it's taking active power to make those colors. It's because the actual material is that color. So that's kind of what this is. You've got a screen. It's a monochrome screen, so no color. But you can go between white and black and any gray in between. I'm not sure what the... like how many different shades of gray it has. I wouldn't be surprised if it was only 16, though, because there's some dithering on the screen. But it's pretty cool because it really kind of reads like paper. You know, you mm-hmm. like last night I was reading a book for at least an hour and a half, and I didn't get any real eye fatigue compared to reading articles online. You know, even avoiding scrolling and stuff, which I've read, does increase eye fatigue. Even avoiding scrolling and just kind of paging down, you know, my eyes would get tired pretty quickly looking at a backlit screen. So it'll be really interesting to see when these displays become cheap enough and fast enough in changing states and everything to do something like computer programming on it. I would totally choose that over looking at a really expensive light bulb for 8 hours a day.
Well, there are some products that are trying to go in that model. One that comes to mind is Notion Ink's mm-hmm. Atom tablet.
Yeah, but they're expensive, though.
Yes, but this is always going to be the case with new technology,
sure.
Where... That screen is done by a company called Pixelkey, or mm-hmm. QI. I don't know how that would be pronounced. I think it's Pixel Key. And that one has a dual state, one which is a full color, and another one is a transflective. In other words, the outside light makes it brighter, so it can be viewed in full sunlight. So it's not as energy efficient as e-ink, but it's more efficient than your typical flat panel LED.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, and also with LEDs, you know, the brighter it is outside, the less you're going to be able to see it. Whereas with e-ink, the darker it is, the less you're going to be able to see it. So we really, it really is kind of...
Right. E-ink is a lot closer to the actually having a book in front of you that you need to have a night
light. Yeah, you need a light to see it. Exactly. And they do have color e-ink type of technology. The colors are not nearly as vibrant, and that makes some sense, you know. But and so I think that there may be some hesitation as far as moving toward that technology, because consumers will see the screen and say, oh, that's not as vibrant or whatever, and kind of miss the difference.
Yeah, the big issue I see there is that someone's going to have one of these things and, can I watch YouTube on it? And the answer mm-hmm. is no, because they don't update fast enough. They're updating, what, every it takes a second and a half.
Yeah, like if I press it right now, go, it sits there. Okay, and now it just updated, you know? So it takes about...
Second and a half or 2 seconds.
Yeah, it takes between, I think, half a second and a second and a half, depending, I think, on what its current state is, which I haven't seen as an issue when I'm reading, because your eyes always take a little second to get from the bottom of the screen to the top of the screen, you know? And also, we tend to ignore... those eye movements, those saccades, is that what it's called, the eye movements? Yeah, we have we ignore when our eyes kind of jump around, and we kind of fill in that temporally. We ignore the amount of time that it takes to do that and don't really perceive it. And so as a result, when I was looking at the Kindle before I started reading on it, I was like, yeah, the screen takes a little while to update. But once I started reading, I didn't notice it at all, and it wasn't a problem. So it's definitely a very good reading device. It's not an iPad by any means, you know, and it doesn't do really anything that
it's
the
iPad
does.
Yeah, they're different markets.
It does do a couple of things that I really, really appreciate, though. It does have a web browser. It's based on WebKit web browser, and it is a really difficult to use web browser, because it's on a completely different screen that refreshes really slowly, and it's over a very slow connection. But the advantage, though, of using that is the 3G works in most countries. Like, I know it doesn't work in Germany, but it does work in most European countries. So when I was over traveling around there, it would have been really nice to have this so I could load up a map. You know, maybe it'll take me 2 minutes to navigate the interface to find a stupid map, but at least I get a map ultimately instead of being stuck with no map. It also will play music, and again, that's another feature that's not, it doesn't compare to other ones, but it's kind of cool it has that feature. You can't make playlists or any of that stuff, but you can just play MP3s that are in a folder on your Kindle. And lastly,
your own little personal Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Exactly. And instead of bringing a towel everywhere you go, bring a Kindle. So it also does text-to-speech, and I was listening to a book being read on the way over here when I was coming over to do the show just today, and it was surprisingly good. You know, there were things that it clearly missed, like some character exclaims and then it said Mrs. blah blah blah, and it gets the cadence of that completely wrong. And it takes a little bit of extra work on my part to figure out what it's actually saying. But I kind of did get myself lost in the book with the text-to-speech, and that's saying a lot too. So overall, I would say Kindle, awesome, absolutely awesome.
So speaking of technology.
Yes.
One of the limitations that we have for various technologies, and this also includes emerging technologies with regard to making things more energy efficient, better battery technology and the like, are what are known as rare earth elements.
Mm-hmm.
And we had covered a story probably a year ago or so about how people were noticing that there'd be a problem with the fact that, for example, China has a huge store of rare earth elements. The vast majority on the planet actually found in China. Hmm. And China, of course, for their own self-interest, wants to be able to use them themselves, not just give them away to other countries. So there is that worry about where are we going to get that information from if we ever get on China's bad side or get those materials from. Japan has made some discoveries where rare earth minerals have been found on the Pacific Ocean seabed. And this is something that is very interesting to me, both from a, oh, well, there's another source for these elements, and also a concern of from many environmentalists of, what, are we going to be strip mining the ocean floor? Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like a great idea.
Definitely not.
And they've been looking in 78 different locations around Japan, and many of them have been coming back with a lot of these materials. And so not limited to one particular government. You have these wide swaths of area that are not controlled by a particular country that have these rare earth minerals.
That's interesting. So who owns, quote unquote, those minerals? And does anyone really have the, I guess, right to take them? Of course, legally, they could just go in and take them.
Well, international waters, there's actually a lot of different treaties that that define like how you're going to use it, or rather, very specific areas where you can, and everything else is kind of. But you also have treaties about overfishing or like, although they're very much unenforceable. A lot of times.
That's definitely true. Yeah, I mean, you can make all the laws or anything that you want, but if you can't actually enforce them, then, you know, what's the point in some cases?
Right, but it does strike me, when you hear people mining under the ocean floor, it does bring to mind an acute scarcity. Like, for example, when we have offshore drilling for oil. We used to drill for oil on land. In fact, the first oil fields were just, oil would bubble up to the surface, and they'd use that. It was very easy. And now we're going to the Gulf of Mexico and drilling down, thousands of meters to get this under high pressure. And we're doing so, I mean, quite obviously, because the economics are horrible for it. You're doing it because you can't get it elsewhere. And that same thing may be happening with the rare earth elements. So as we go there, it means we're starting to feel the crunch already. And you're going to have that economic model fighting now with the ecology of the bottom ocean.
And there's a lot there, too. I mean, I know that most of the world's biomass is in the oceans. I'm not sure how much of that resides on the seafloor, but I'd wager a guess is that it's some decent amount of it. So, yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. So
now that we've gotten through with that depressing story.
Oh.
Ben, your next one.
Okay. Today, I have to cover Facebook news. Of course I have to cover Facebook news. So, at least the first part of my story is not a negative thing about Facebook. For once, that actually kind of excites me. Facebook came out with this thing that they were calling before the press conference, a very exciting announcement. Really, really exciting, really interesting. And they announced video calling powered by Skype. And then they also announced group chat. And I wasn't really too amazed by that, because I mean, we already have video calling. Of course, Facebook has the network, has this ginormous social network that they can leverage to bring video calling to pretty much the masses, right? But we already had that. You know, Skype had that on its own, and Google Chat already had that, has had it for a while. And then we also have group chat, and group chat we have had for a while in numerous platforms as well, including Google. So it was just kind of, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people were thinking, oh, okay, well, Google Plus was just released, so Facebook is retaliating by releasing this product, you know, and it doesn't quite work that way. It takes months and months and months to develop a product like that. So you can't just decide to, you know, up and release video calling and develop it in a week or anything. So they were probably not really related. They were probably two companies converging on a consumer interest at the same time. But we've had one-way video calling and group video chat in Gmail for ages and ages. So I don't know how interesting it is. You know, it'll be interesting to see it on Facebook's platform because it's definitely by far the largest, I would say, but kind of underwhelming. but there also is a negative, and this is a unrelated negative, but there's a new Facebook scam, as usual. Of course, there's always a new Facebook scam, but this one is pretty interesting, I think, to people who don't know about it. And so if you ever see on Facebook something that says, you know, hey, click here to check out the new video feature on Facebook or something like that, and it's posted on someone's wall, or click here to video chat, kind of like click here to hang out on Google Plus, don't click on it because it's a scam. So it's interesting to see that, you know, like, how are people going to know before anyone's video chatted, how are they going to know which links actually go to video chat and which links are scams? I guess when you have that many people on a network, you know, you see a lot of interesting things.
That
like this
sounds
happening.
To me very much like it's Facebook's responsibility to policing those ads mm-hmm. that are showing up.
But yeah, but I'd imagine that's got to be a Herculean effort, you know, with what, like...
Well, everything on Facebook scale is going to be a huge effort.
Yeah, I guess they'll have to do it programmatically somehow, but I don't know how they're going to do it. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying is just be careful, you know? Like, if you see a link, click here to get exclusive this or exclusive that, or Justin Bieber this, or, you know, video chat that.
Or even better, if it says anything about Justin Bieber, just don't click on it.
Yeah, just never click on it, yeah. Your IQ might go up.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Justin. I know you're listening to Geek Speak. So anyway, that's my Facebook news. So
wonderful. So I'm going to do a nice little tidbit, which is there has always been the ability to generate power wirelessly. It's never been a huge amount of power, but it's, for example, people are able to make an antenna that can harness energy from radio waves or from cell towers.
Yeah, because light, radio waves, that is energy.
Exactly. Well, yeah.
I mean, well, it's, yeah.
It can be converted to energy.
Very
yes.
easily, yeah. So that's what solar power is.
Right. So think of a solar cell. That's a great example. Think of a solar photovoltaic cell, and that is light being converted to a current. What people don't tend to think of is when you're listening to our broadcast right now, chances are it's over the radio. That is just another frequency of light. If you are listening over the podcast, yeah, whatever, that doesn't fit with this analogy. But but it is just another frequency of light, which means that you could have the equivalent of a photovoltaic cell. It's not really the same, but it's a different way of converting that that transmission to an electrical current.
Yeah, all it is electromagnetic energy, like EM waves, right? And
right.
you just convert that.
Well, electricity and magnetism are intimately related
sure.
to one another.
Yeah.
And what this group at Georgia Tech have done is figured out a way to, using an inkjet printer with a special type of ink that has some nanoparticles into it, print out these tuned antennas. And what makes their discovery that much more interesting is the fact that it's not limited to just a few kilohertz in terms of bandwidth. They're actually able to capture anywhere from 100 megahertz to 15 gigahertz.
Oh, wow. Like all at the same time?
I don't know if it's at the same time, but at the same time, when I'm looking at these photos, they have very varied shapes on there, which kind of speaks to me like they are capturing wider areas over a longer, a wider spectrum over different parts of the antenna.
That's pretty cool. I mean, you know, if you just take the sun as an example, the sun spits out all kinds of energies over all kinds of wavelengths, you know, so that's
right.
why
we were able to capture that one pretty easy, photovoltaic cells.
Yeah, exactly.
We
but I mean, also heat or also, you know, microwave radiation. Or I mean, well, actually, I guess that's a bad example because a lot of the higher end stuff gets filtered out by our atmosphere. Thank goodness, or we'd all have cancer
right.
or we just wouldn't exist.
But it is not all unicorns and rainbows.
I was hoping you wouldn't say that. Why?
All of the amounts of energy harvested are on the order of 50 milliwatts.
Ooh.
So well, to give you an idea, that's very, very small. That's much lower than the amount that your cell phone would be required to make a call, for example, to be on a phone.
Like the power from the battery or whatever. It's much less than that.
Right. However, if you were to couple that with a capacitor, some way of storing that power.
You could charge, huh?
Then you can do a slow charge, which means that you could have something that would be... over time, it could charge. But also, you could also have something like sensors. A sensor array that only has to give out data at a very short interval, and it doesn't require that much power to run. This is the type of thing that could be very useful.
What about a Kindle? What if the entire backside of the Kindle was a gigantic cell?
Well, if you can find out how much power it uses, not to mention it depends on how slow a reader you are.
Yeah.
If you're a very slow reader, it's going to have a lot more time to charge up.
Otherwise. I'm a really slow reader. I turn the page once every hour. So, no.
It could also have something that under normal operation, it works just fine. But if there's, like, for example, if it's just monitoring, if a radio signal was still working, it worked fine. And that would be charging up during that period of time. But then if the radio signal ever stopped, then it has the senses that it's not getting the incoming information anymore and then can send out a warning message, you know, that type of thing. So very limited usage in terms of power output, but still a very cool technology.
Yeah, that's really cool because I'm sure, at least in the scientific or observation and everything community, there's got to be tons of sensors out there that they want to deploy, but they need a little bit of a little bit of power, and they need to be out there for 10 years or something like that. So, like, how do they get even just a small amount of power over 10 years? A huge hunkin' battery? What if they could just do it this way?
Right. And just to make this clear, in case someone wants to call in and think of all these different areas they can, Ben, can you describe why or why not the cell phone energy coming from a cell phone would be able to charge that cell phone?
Wait, the cell phone energy coming from a cell phone charging itself?
Yeah.
Because that's a closed loop. That's a perpetual motion machine.
Yes. So yeah. I just wanted to put that out there that even when people talk about like, well, I'll just listen to my radio and or I'll talk on my cell phone and the cell phone's giving out that electromagnetic radiation to be able to talk to the cell tower. That there's always going to be someone who's going to put some variation of that saying, and I'll be able to make this product that does, that gives that feedback to it.
Yeah.
You're never going to get out of a system more than you put into it.
When I was little, I was really, really interested. Oh, yeah. And if you ever do seem to get that, there's something else putting energy into the system, be it, heat or
far more likely someone is lying to you and trying to scam you out of your money.
If you discover a perpetual motion machine, make sure there isn't something else putting energy into the system. But when I was a little kid, I was really interested in perpetual motion machines. And I was always reading all these riddles about perpetual motion machines and everything and thinking, why wouldn't that work and everything? And once I put two motors together and I tried to power one motor with using the other motor as a generator, and it just totally
didn't
work.
Well,
no, of course not. But that was how I learned there's no free lunch.
KOSB co-sponsors the 2011 Carmel Bach Festival, a 15-day celebration of music and ideas with films and lectures, chamber concerts, and full orchestral performances, July 16th through the 30th. Tickets and information, 624-1521 or bachfestival.org. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. I am Miles Elam. With me in the air room is Ben Jaffe. And I have a geek bit for everyone today. I'll be putting this up on the website after the show is over. And that is a talk done by Bill Gates.
Who's Bill Gates?
It's some guy who wrote some software a while back. I don't know. Some dude. And he was actually, let me give out the phone numbers and I'll finish up this geek bit. The phone numbers to call in with your question and comments are 1-800-655-5877 or locally 476-2800. So, Bill Gates. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is known nowadays for their work with regard to vaccines and health and the quality of life of what is commonly referred to as the bottom 2 billion, the third of the population on the planet that has a very hard time getting by. The infant mortality rates are very high. The rates of death and disease are much higher than the rest of the population. And their access to energy and information is much, much lower than the rest of us. Than, for example, the what's known as the connected 2 billion, of which we are a part. And if you are listening to this on the radio or listening to this on the podcast, you are a part of that connected 2 billion. And he talks about, but in this case, he's talking about energy. Energy production. And it's a very interesting TED Talk that I highly recommend, and I'll be putting a link up on the website after the show. And it is basically talking about what our options are and what the challenges are. And I think it's something that everyone can get something from, whether it be some further ideas, some basic knowledge or information, or if you already know this information, it gives you a focal point to be able to point people in that direction, saying, well, hey, just watch this thing. This thing is a lot of really good, easy-to-absorb information that really lays out what's at stake.
I found TED Talks are really fantastic in general. You should just go watch all of them, but start with the one that Miles just recommended.
So let's take some phone calls. We have a call already.
Oh, yeah. I had a really quick geek bit.
Oh, certainly.
If you have an Android device, Google Maps just updated their software. And now you can download the map of an area within 10 miles of a particular, like a 10 by 10 radius on a map. So let's say you're going to, I don't know, Frankfurt, Germany, or somewhere in Belgium or whatever, and you want to download some large area because you're going to be navigating around and everything, you can download a 10 by 10 mile radius. If you're in Europe, that would be 16 by 16 kilometers. And you can download that map data, and that means you don't have to have a data connection, right? So that's really fantastic. I really, really wish they had done that back in March when I left for Europe and not in July right when I came back, but that's okay. Pretty cool.
Yes, indeed. So we have a phone call. This from Caleb in Monterey. Hello.
Hi. My question was about Firefox.
Okay, the web browser, yes.
Yes. And I use Windows 7, and I just noticed that, you know, it seems like I was using Firefox 3.something, and then 4.0 came out a few weeks ago or a month or so ago. I downloaded it, had problems, and suddenly now there's Firefox 5 or Firefox 5 beta out, and I'm just wondering, what's the deal with Firefox? It was this really dependable, reliable browser I used for so long, and now it seems to kind of suck. It doesn't like several websites that I visit, particularly regarding security features and things like that.
I don't know about specific websites. I personally haven't had a problem with the newer Firefoxes in that regard, but then again, I don't know if I'm the target audience for that. The reason why the numbers are going up so much faster is a response to Google Chrome. And this idea of instead of, whereas Firefox previously, they released a browser every, you know, year, every 18 months, something like that, in between. You were going from version 3.6 to 4.0, you know, that took a while. And 3.5 to 3.6 took a while. And 3.0 to 3.5, it took quite a while. So version 3.0 came out in, I want to say, 2008?
Yeah, so three years ago. That's pretty much an eternity, right?
Well, compared to Internet Explorer, world, they're still doing very well, but... what happened was because they had these long stretches of time, it was slowing down some of the progress for some of those newer technologies, and also for just for moving things ahead to try to as a web developer, I know it's really hard for me to describe some of the things that are going on that we're chomping at the bit waiting to use these technologies to be able to get them out into the world, and a faster browser cycle gets them there faster.
Yeah.
Chrome was the one that pioneered this to be able to say, oh, well, we're just going to release a new version every 3 weeks.
Yeah, you know, Chrome is on version 12 right now. At least that's the version I have. They're working on 13. It's probably right around the corner. And they released Chrome in 2008.
Yeah, Chrome 6 was out, and that was a brand new version 1 year ago.
Chrome 6, and now we're on Chrome 12. So, you know, they're pushing through these version numbers pretty quickly.
So, yeah, so what the Firefox group is doing right now is trying to follow closer to that model of a lot more releases, but not as much changes in each release. So that you can get some of those new features out faster and not wait for the big drop-off. Now, I'm curious about the problems that you're seeing with the new version, because as I said, I haven't seen them myself.
Well, yeah, so specifically I have one for my work for logging in and checking my schedule. It's called RP2 or something like that. I guess it's some big business thing that's used. And, now the website runs security check on the computer, so it checks the computer to make sure you have a firewall and up-to-date antivirus and stuff like that. And when I try using a Firefox, it's like, sorry, you know, not supported with Firefox version 4. And then also with my school, we have several components that say, you know, this is not compatible with Firefox version 4. And so I was wondering if version 4 was bunk and I should go back to 3 and then start 5 when 5 is released, or should I just wait it out until 5 comes?
Well, that sounds very much like this isn't a Firefox add-in, right? This is the website you're going to?
Yes.
Okay. So what's happening is they're doing a practice which I'm afraid I'm going to have to do the whole wrist slap on them. They're doing user agent sniffing, which is they're saying like, oh, well, we support these particular versions of it. So, and the reason behind that was to say, well, we don't support Firefox 2 anymore, so we want to make sure that they're above that level at a newer version.
But now Firefox 5 is identifying it differently from what it knows it supports, and they haven't updated their software to allow it.
Right. So rather than check to see whether the features that they're using are available, they're checking to see whether our version string matches. And that is causing some problems.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not really much that you can do about it except just wait until they kind of get their act together and on the websites that are having problems, you know, and instead of doing browser detection, doing feature detection. But until that happens, you're kind of stuck having to use a browser that they officially support. And I put that in quotes.
Right. Many companies have another issue with this. And the reason why they don't want to do the newer versions as well, just to play devil's advocate, is because if they have a product that's out there, they need to do QA on it. Mm-hmm. They need to do testing on that. And they need to certify that, yes, if that works, and I know that it's going, you know, if something goes wrong, we know that it's our fault and we can go fix it. People are using many different browsers and many different configurations. It becomes much harder to nail it down to be able to diagnose a problem and get it a working experience.
Yeah.
But in this case, I think they've been a little too overzealous.
Yeah. A couple quick things. Go ahead.
I was going to have a quick follow-up to this. So the funny part is that it says they don't. This feature does not support Firefox 4, but I'm using Firefox 4 and it seems to work. Am I exposing myself to some security risk?
I don't know that you're...
Email and things like that.
Yeah. Firefox 4 does have some security vulnerabilities that have come out, and the Mozilla folks, those are the ones who make Firefox, have made an interesting choice in saying that the fix for Firefox 4 is to get Firefox 5 rather than do patch releases for the previous version. So I don't know that Firefox 4 is a totally bunk version. I think it's actually pretty good, but... the difference between Firefox 4 and Firefox 5 is so minimal that it's actually pretty useful to go to that new version. But as you said, you're going to run into some problems where some sites are going to say, well, I've never heard of that. That's obviously a browser we don't support.
Yeah, as far as steps that you can take, you're probably just going to have to use Firefox 3.something or 3.6 or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can install multiple versions of Firefox on your Windows machine, though you do have to Google to figure out how to do that. There are just a couple steps you have to go through and make profiles.
You can install them all at the same time. You just can't run them at the same time unless you set a profile.
Oh, okay,
so
good point.
So if you download version 3.6 again, like you already have 4, mm-hmm. I'm sure it overwrote your existing installation. Yeah. You can download 3.6 once again and install that into a different directory. and you can run that okay. just fine.
Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
One of the reasons it hasn't been a problem for Chrome, though, is that they just update without telling you. So,
right, and it's very hard to see what version you have. You just, as far as most users are concerned, and I think this is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
they're just using Chrome.
They're not using Chrome version 11 or version 12, or someone says, what browser version number are you using? And most users are going to say, I don't know, because they don't know. They never upgraded to Chrome 12. It just upgraded for them.
Right. And I think it prompts them. I'm sure people who use Chrome have seen this before. Yeah. It prompts you every once in a while. It says, hey, there's an update to Chrome available. Do you want to do that? And it may not be a new version update. It may just be a patch release for a particular security bug.
Yeah.
And that's like many other browsers, except that it's much more seamless. You don't see it. And that's one of the advantages of having that very fast iteration cycle that I was talking about, where so many versions of Chrome have come out in such a short period of time, where the changes become such a gradual thing that they're not shocking. You don't have a shocking new version out that you go, wait, this is totally different from what I'm used to. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of little changes a lot more often so that people can get used to it and they're not shocked by that. They don't have that astonishment and that apprehension from it.
And having that auto-update mechanism, I think personally, is in almost all cases fantastic for the user, because they don't need to know how to install an update or da-da-da-da-da. It just does it for them.
Right.
Whereas, you know, with the latest version of Firefox or whatever, you know, you might have to go and download a DMG file on the Mac, double click on it, click and drag it into the applications folder, replace the thing, and then you're done. And some people don't know how to do that, you know. So
right. And a fun fact about Chrome, when it downloads, they're using a technology that they've that's been developed by Google themselves, that was called Courget.
Wait, what?
Courget. Yeah, and that was a way of making the downloads that much smaller, because they're basically doing a binary diff on the patch.
Yeah.
So instead of having to download 3 megabytes or more, like, which is very common
for updates.
The
entire application.
No, not necessarily the entire application. For example, Firefox, when you do updates, many times they are smaller chunks.
Yeah.
But it's still 3 or 4 megabytes at a time. With Google, they may do a patch release, and that patch, even though it has the same amount of information because of the technology they're using as a binary diff and then reassembling the program to reset the memory offsets after the fact, after it's downloaded, you're downloading 100K to get what was normally a megabyte.
A tenth of a megabyte instead of 1 megabyte or 3 megs or whatever.
Or even greater differences.
Pretty cool.
So that was a nice little...
Now that everyone's tired of us talking about browser updates, who's next?
Oh, and we have an off-air suggestion from Bill for Caleb in Monterey. There's another possibility to solve your problem, which is you go into Firefox 4 or Firefox 5, and you download an add-on for it to change your user agent. And basically, you make your Firefox look like Firefox 3.6 when it advertises it to the server. And chances are everything will still work, but the server will think that you're using that previous version.
Although he did say he was using Firefox 4 and it said this isn't supported, but it still worked. So I wonder if that even matters.
Sure.
It just won't tell you, oh, this doesn't work, but it will.
Right. But for other folks that are out there that have a website and says, and they stop working when you put in a new browser, and you know that new browser is kind of cool and you want to still use it, there is that possibility of making it pretend to be a different browser.
Yeah.
That user agent changer. Actually, the add-on, I believe, is called User Agent Switcher.
Is it called? Okay. I didn't know what it was called.
So moving on to other calls. We have Jackson in South Carolina.
Actually, I'm in Santa Cruz.
You're in Santa Cruz. I'm sorry, SC. I was thinking of the postal code. Yes, thank
you. Well, briefly, I'll touch on your Google thing, and I'll get off the subject. I have had a problem recently, while not with Chrome, but with the Google updater, that there is a Trojan that comes along with it that attacks PCs running XP or Vista. It downloads the fake antivirus. Basically, it downloads the auto-run sequence, and it will attempt to switch, if you have IE running, over to a proxy server and download the rest. And I've been able to get rid of it. There's, you know, ways around it by dumping the Google updater service. So those running PCs, this is something that happened to me about a week ago on an XP system, I would recommend not having Google update automatically. And when you do have an update, check the file with an antivirus program that you trust, Malwarebytes or AVG or the like, before you launch it. I don't know if you guys had a problem, but that's something within the past 2 weeks I've had an issue with on XPPC.
Yeah, although some certain antivirus definitions do flag the updater as a Trojan virus, and that was an error. And so actually a false positive. So, the antivirus companies and all of that all say that as well.
Right. It's not actually the updater itself is being, it will get flagged. In this case, I'm using SpyBot S&D. Mm-hmm. It will flag the fake antivirus program that shows up. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but you'll be browsing along, and some websites will have it embedded, and if you don't have a surf shield engaged, it'll come up with, warning, you have a potential corruptions on your machine, and you have a choice to click OK or cancel. Doesn't matter what you click, it's going to launch the fake antivirus program, which is a worm that slowly eats up your hard drive. Your choice is to abort.
When you're talking about the Google updater, which Google updater are you referring to?
I'm referring to the one that comes automatically with Chrome.
Googleupdate.exe?
Yes.
Yeah, so that is, as we were saying, a false positive. So that's actually not the case. It is not a Trojan. And
right.
I would certainly...
What I'm saying is the Trojan doesn't... It's not that it is a Trojan. The Trojan comes through the Google updater on certain files that get updated. I can't tell you what files we're updating, but I tracked it back to a file that came across the Google updater, not as part of Google updater, but as part of the update stream, the update data stream. So I'm
We'll look into that, and we'll see what we can find out, and we'll report on that a little bit more in detail next week. If you can give us some more information, we'd love that. Shoot us an email.
Okay. And the reason why I called, actually, was you guys had asked why can't power to charge a battery be transmitted along with radio frequency energy, right?
Well, we were posing the question, why can't a cell phone and the transmissions from the cell phone charge itself?
Okay, well, here's the issue. Cell phones, I'll make it very simple. I'm a semi-retired broadcast engineer. I have a license, et cetera, et cetera. Very simply, the emissions from a modern cell phone are measured in milliwattage output, and the received signal strength at the cell phone itself or any radio is measured in microvolts per square meter or millivolts per square meter. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a very small fraction of voltage. When I say 200 milliwatts, that is 200 milliwatts worth of power or current into a given antenna impedance load. And so it breaks down to, again, microvolts. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is, now Tesla originally had this idea years and years ago of building power stations across the country. It would be these large, basically transmitting Tesla coils that would transmit heavy electromagnetic energy and provide an energy source. The problem is that you'd have to generate so much power at the transmitting antenna that it would be dangerous for people. If you're in proximity to a transmitting antenna, say a large AM or FM radio station, the power there is measured in amperes coming off the antenna. And if you're within a few hundred yards of the antenna, you'll read voltage per square meter. But you get more than a few hundred feet away, and you're down to millivolts or microvolts per square meter.
Yeah.
And again, transmitting off the cell phone, modern cell phones, smartphones are limited to 200 milliwatts. That's 0.2 watt of power into a 53-ohm antenna, which calculates out, top of my head, you're talking about maybe 30 or 40 microvolts.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, yeah, so, that's the point we were kind of tongue-in-cheekily making, that within a closed-loop system, even if you have almost 100% in that loop, you're never going to be able to generate electricity unless you have an external source. So,
Perpetual motioning. Now you're talking about almost
exactly.
Yeah,
well, thanks so much.
Thank you for your call, Jackson.
Well, last question, though. I want you guys to answer this. What about the biological microprocessor? I was told last night that it has come out. It's not consumer available yet, but there is a microprocessor that is a biological element. It uses a UV light source, and it is fed some sort of food, and it can learn.
Well, right. And this is an area that's been researched for quite some time. In fact, someone has made a basic microprocessor, believe it or not, from a potato.
Yes. I've noticed that when I was searching for it on the web last night.
So
if you guys could expound on that, I'd be interested to know. And I'll be happy to shoot you guys an email. And I'm off to pick up my brother. Have a nice morning. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
And let's see, we can get another call in. So let's try out Mario and Salinas. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, this is Mario from Salinas.
Yeah, your question?
Yeah, I had a question about my PC. I'm having trouble every time I open my iTunes. The whole resolution gets changed on my PC. Everything looks really big.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to see if you know how to fix that.
Were you running any like visualization software with iTunes? No, that still wouldn't.
Maybe. iTunes does have a visualizer, so you know you can set it so when you play music, it comes up with all kinds of interesting visualizations.
Right.
And I think that if you put it in full screen mode, it might maybe on lower resolution, but change the screen resolution on slower computers. But I don't think it's done that for years.
What I would actually suggest is making sure that your video drivers are up to date. It might be tickling some bug in there, because that's odd behavior.
That's very
whenever
odd
I hear odd behavior having to do with video, video drivers are one of the first things that I want to go look at.
It did the same thing with Google Chrome, because I have Internet Explorer, and I put Google Chrome and it did the same thing, so I just took it off. And it's doing the same with my iTunes.
Yeah, so if it's happening with multiple applications, it's probably not Chrome or iTunes which are causing the problem. They're probably just, they're not the root of the problem is what I mean. They're probably just doing something that initiates the problem or the resolution change or something like that. So, yeah, I think I would second Miles's suggestion to check your video card drivers.
If you don't know how to do that, I don't want to talk about it over the phone, because it's something that you should have someone who knows what to get and how to install it. So I would find a friend who has done that before, or take it to a computer shop to have those updated.
Yeah. Or even just look at
that. If you're not comfortable with it. Sorry?
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So you think it's going to be the drivers?
That would be the first thing that I would check. I'm not sure, but that's the first thing that comes to mind. That's the first red flag that I would think about.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we're running out of time, so I have to get going. But I wish the best. And if you find out what's wrong with it, or if the video drivers help, please fire us off an email and see if and give us some feedback to know whether your problem was solved.
Yeah, definitely interested.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. And we are coming up on the end of our show. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. More information at cruise.io.com. The Otter Project seeks volunteers in the Santa Cruz, Monterey, and Big Sur regions to help monitor marine protected areas along the California coast. Information is available at otterproject.org or 646-8837. Once again, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. I've been your host, Miles Elam. With me has been Ben Jaffe.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission.